Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Susan Downs, a member of the club's Science and Medical Committee, and your chair for today. We welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at thecommonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. James Laval is a doctorate in pharmacy, a clinical nutritionist, and a naturopath. Has 18-plus year of clinical practice and experience in the field of natural therapeutics and functional medicine. He received his license in pharmacology from the University of Cincinnati College of Pharmacy, certification as a clinical nutritionist from the International and American Associations of Clinical Nutritionists, and is doctor of naturopathic medicine from the Central States College of Health Sciences. He is currently in clinical practice at the Lavelle Metabolic Institute. He is a member of the Scientific Advisory Board for the Dietary Supplement Education Alliance. He's an adjunct associate professor in the College of Pharmacy at the University of Cincinnati, and he serves as a preceptor in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. He's the author of 14 books, the latest being Crack the Metabolic Code, and is an adjunct professor in the College of Pharmacy, University of Cincinnati. I welcome James Laval.
A big first step. All right. So we only have a little bit of time together tonight. And as always, I always put too many slides in my presentations and I probably talk too fast. And so what we'll do is we'll try to leave time for questions. But there's some key concepts I want to get by tonight. If I stand up this tall, I'm going to be at the real biological height I should have been. Oh, wait, I just let my Napoleonic self get out, didn't I? Oh, boy. So I don't think that's going to work for me. So anyway, I'm much more of a leaner. So anyway, here's what I want to try and get across to you tonight, that there are a lot of variables that affect how your health is going to transform during your lifetime. And one of the projects that I've worked on over the last, actually, 28 years of being involved in what I would call more of an integrative approach to the discipline of why we heal and what do we do with, you know, how do we work with people together? How do we, you know, I always thought of our patients at the Institute of, we were partners. You know, I had things to learn. They had things to learn. We're going to grow together. And hopefully the outcome of that is that they're getting well and I'm gaining insight. That's really what the goal has been throughout my career. And I've been very fortunate to have great mentors along the way. And so a big project came up. I just want to lead off with this so you understand that the scope of wellness is changing. And I'm not telling you this because, wow, aren't I a great guy that I did this. But there's a company called Lifetime Fitness. They have fitness centers all across the United States, 1.2 million members. 3 years ago, they came to me and said, you know what? Our weight loss programs are not working. And they weren't working because what they were doing is they were basing all of their weight loss on a calories in, calories out train philosophy. If you just exercise and you cut your calories, you're going to get to your ideal weight in 12 weeks no matter what, because you're going to lose 65 calories a day. And we're going to multiply that by how many days, and that's how many pounds you're going to lose. Well, the problem is that people would come in after 12 weeks, they would get on the scale, and they would go, I gained 4 pounds. Yeah, but it's lean muscle. Aren't you happy that you got lean muscle? No, I gained 4 pounds. That's what was going on, and that's what's going on all over the country, because the reality is, there are several reasons why people's metabolisms start to fail. And that's what I've spent my life doing. I mean, I got all the people would come in. I would always come, I'm more of a metabolic detective, if you want to think about what I do. I want to dig in and find out what's wrong with your pathways. How do we personalize this for you? And so what we did was we took 2,400 trainers and 50 registered dietitians. Now there's 100. And we changed their culture from an exercise trainer to a healthy way of life trainer. How am I going to instill habits, behaviors, and the lifestyle changes that are going to promote the goals of an individual and maybe even get them well. And we're going to use that with dietitians as well. And pretty interesting, over 3 years, we developed the questionnaire and we developed some wellness labs. About 200,000 people took the survey, took the labs, and then acted on it. And they've had just tracking all the data on it, and they're getting more weight loss than they've ever gotten in their history. And the reason for that is we're identifying things like, oh, you didn't realize that when you get home and you're really angry about your kid, you know, maybe not showing up for school 3 days in a row, that might contribute to the third Sunday that you've eaten today. Or that you mowed through a box of cookies and the third cookie you went, I'm going to stop. I'm done. I'm not eating another one. No way. Well, maybe one. And then you eat that one and you go, oh, that was kind of good. Maybe I'll have one more because I'm not sure if it was good. I'm thinking it was good. Four is not enough to tell out if it's really good. And you get to number seven and you go, your brain's telling you, I know it's not good anymore. It doesn't even feel good in my belly, but your brain is still saying, you need a reward. Do it. Go ahead and have that cookie. Finish it. Finish the row. It's just a row of Oreos. You've done it so many times before. What's the big deal? Right? So that's one of the issues. Reward behaviors. When people get stressed out, they have a reward issue, and that's usually because they've either got a gene for the dopamine, it's called an allele 2 dopamine gene, and that's what's called the alcohol gene. So people that are alcoholic, you know, you hear about it being a, you know, genetic predisposition. It's the same thing that gets triggered. It may not be alcohol, but it could be gambling. It could be eating. It could be shopping. It's that addictive reward I have to have, right? So we taught these guys how to begin to understand when somebody tells you they have these reward problems, you can tell them, okay, I want you to exercise 45 minutes a day, and you're going to do your stretching. You're going to wake up in the morning, and you're going to talk to the plants, and you're going to put a nice set of nubby Birkenstocks on to break up all your little acupressure points that are going on underneath your feet. And then after you do that and you talk to the plant, you can go to the therapist, and you'll talk to the therapist, and then you'll send your therapist to a therapist to make sure you keep yourself in balance. All that stuff doesn't matter when the stressor of life hits me and that reward cascade is triggered. And the result of that is, after years of working with people, is I'm bad. I don't have willpower. There's something wrong with me. And it's liberating when you start to explain things to people about how their chemistry works and how, look, you still have to take on personal responsibility. I'm not going to blame it all on a gene switch. Right? There's a balance between your personal responsibility and the cards you've been dealt. Okay, let's take that on. All right? And so really, this has been the first organization to do this, to take on 250,000 people and start to do more than a calories in, calories out environment and really start to assess people as individuals. That's what our talk about today is. It's about personalized fitness. I'm going to give you one more story about a thing that we did as well. Here's another program that we did that I learned a lot on. It was called Corvette Racing. So Le Mans, if you're familiar with the Le Mans race, it's like the equivalent of the Super Bowl, right? If you're in Europe and the Le Mans is a big race. The Corvette race team, you know, nice guys, they were having trouble finishing the race because you have to race for 4 hours and then you get out of the car, then you got to sleep. And then you got to get back in the car. And then you got to drive at 180 miles an hour. And then you got to get back out of the car. And then you got to try to sleep. Well, they seem to wreck their cars a lot, which I think, you know, the interesting thing is they'll have a team of 50 engineers on this car designing it for Le Mans, right? Do you know how many people they have working on the drivers? None. Not one thing was done to support the driver's chemistry. And the driver's machinery is much more complex than that car. And so what we were tasked to do was to create a personalized program to optimize their performance. And so we did that. And we used techniques, not just techniques to get them alert and then to calm them down when they came out of their car, but we also did things like acupuncture when they got out and laid down to calm down their nervous system. And then we would do different techniques to invigorate them to get them back up. And lo and behold, they win Le Mans in 2011, and it was a very innovative thing because now there's a lot of other race teams going, hey, can you do that with us? And what it was we evaluated their chemistry and found out their personal weaknesses. One guy, he had gluten intolerance. He couldn't eat gluten-containing grains. Now, he didn't know that. He ate a lot of gluten. And you know what happens when you eat a lot of gluten? For some people, they get foggy-headed. And you know what people do when they're getting ready to have a big endurance race? I'm going to need a lot of energy, aren't I? I think I'm going to carb up a little bit. I can't figure out why I'm going into turn four at 180 miles an hour and my brain isn't saying turn the wheel. I know the curve, it's coming. Right? And we even did things like we had them swallow a pill and measure their core body temperature. You know, we did some pretty interesting stuff with these folks. But regardless, here, what I'm trying to get to is that personalized medicine works for everybody. It works from the member of a fitness club to a very elite level. I mean, one of my cohorts in this is a scientist with NASA, and he does a lot of, you know, kind of space medicine and looking at what happens under extreme stress environments. But the reality is how it affect us. And I love this particular Forbes magazine headline, right? You know, pharma's new enemy, clean living, right? Throw out your Prozac, your Nexium, and your Ambien, right? Now, I'm not here to tell you that drug therapy isn't a value. If you're in healthcare, you know the biggest topic in healthcare is polypharmacy. People taking too many drugs and all the interactions that are going on between them. It's not a big deal. It's just a fact. I mean, and so a lot of what we learned is that, you know what? Maybe we don't need a pill for every ill. Maybe we need to start thinking about how we're going to change our lifestyle, create what I like calling it, and it's probably a little bit trite, but I like to call it a health style. I want a lifestyle that promotes health. No, I'm not going to be perfect. I'm not going to make sure that my wheatgrass is served to me at 89.4 degrees. I'm not going to go that far, right? But I am going to have best practices. What's going to be good for me on a daily basis so I don't, first of all, drive the rest of my family crazy and stress everybody out, right? But at the same time, what am I doing that makes sense? What am I doing on a daily basis? And that's some of the things I want to get you aware of. This is kind of funny on the Affordable Care Act. I just put this in here because it's just humorous to me. Huffington Post. So this was about filing this works the first time. There's going to be Medicare reimbursement for primary care providers that do diet and lifestyle counseling with patients. Doctors aren't trained in weight loss or nutrition at all. I mean, I know I teach at medical school. I still teach as an adjunct professor at University of South Florida, soon to do adjunct travel work probably with George Washington. I know that this doesn't happen, right? It's okay. We're allowed to admit it. And here's the thing. Recent Huffington Post article by David Katz. There's two ways physicians muck up weight management counseling, by providing it and not providing it. Right? They don't get trained in it, so what are they doing? Typically, it's a hypocaloric, liquid diet, right? Those things aren't sustainable, unfortunately. When you look at the data on those, on the kind of the liquid diet types of approaches that we currently are doing, they don't work. And interestingly, I don't know if, for those of you who know bariatric surgery, which can be very successful in some cases, but you know that in a lot of bariatric cases, the folks that get the surgeries end up resorting to other reward cascade issues. So they end up going to alcohol, or they end up going to gambling, or they pick up smoking, go to an AA meeting. I can't drink alcohol anymore, but what am I going to do? I'm gonna cram about 12 Coca-Colas down and smoke 20 cigarettes in an hour. Reward cascade, right? And we have to identify those kind of things if we're going to be successful and really figuring out our own issues, right? I'm a reward cascade guy. I got alcoholism all over my family tree. And I can tell you right now, I'd love a good reward, right? I just have learned I need to temper that, And then this is, once again, this whole accountable care piece, all I'm trying to get across is that at least our government is now saying, we got to be accountable for health and prevention. That's great. That's the first step. For those of us that have been in it for 30 years, we're jumping up and down going, finally, there's recognition. But I got to tell you, I was at the Assistant Surgeon General's office about 6 months ago. It's sitting with this, the Assistant Surgeon General, and he knows the problems. it's just kind of a big country and a lot of people to try to fix at one time, right? It's just we got to think of it as a process. And the process is working. Things are happening because here's what it's all about, right? It's all about risk versus benefit. Man, I want that cheese. I really would like to take that cheese. But I wonder if this is the latest Schutt Ion 4D helmet that is guaranteed not to give me a concussion with a frontal hit. I don't know. But I know one thing. I want that cheese. It's all about that risk versus benefit, right? I want to eat whatever I want. I don't want to have to exercise. Hey, you know what? Sleeping, I'll sleep when I'm dead. These are the things I hear, right? I mean, it's very interesting. Now, I sleep a lot. Really? How much do you sleep? Well, I get 5 hours. Oh, good. And are they broken up? Well, yeah, they're kind of broken up. I usually get up once or twice, maybe do a couple puzzles, and then that'll help me get groggy and get back to sleep. So this book, Cracking the Metabolic Code, it's interesting. I wrote this book. And it kind of became a textbook for a lot of people interested in integrative medicine. Kind of wrote it initially to try to help consumers and physicians and healthcare providers come together, something books usually don't do. Usually it's a quick solution book. Well, if you do purchase this book, there are no pictures in it. There's very few. It's a lot of this is how your body works. And you got to learn about stress, and you have to learn about your gut, and you have to learn about your thyroid. If you want to be an intelligent consumer of health, the first thing you have to do is start to become proactive about yourself and understanding who you are and what may be affecting you so that when the doctor – I just finished writing a book called Blood Never Lies. Why did I write the book Blood Never Lies? How many times has this happened to you? You go to the doctor's office, you get a blood test. Doctor says, you get a phone call. Your labs are normal. Okay, what's that mean? Well, your labs, they're normal. Okay, what labs? Right? A lot of times people don't ask even for the lab test to read. Maybe if you're, this is the point I always make on a lab test. I'll make this point on a slide in a minute, but if I'm one step away from the Grand Canyon's cliff versus a mile away from the Grand Canyon's cliff, which next step is most important? The one you're closest, because you're going to fall. So when I look at lab tests and I see that somebody's 1 point away from being a diabetic, oh, but you're a point away. Come back next year. Then when you're a diabetic, I can tell you you're diabetic. Right? So we have to start looking at how do we start to catch the trends. And that's what's really going on in healthcare now, at least from my end, is we're trying to get people to understand earlier on, where are your risks? Where are you going? I wrote a great book called Where Are You Going years ago. And so it really, this whole process of writing this book was about, and this book just continues to grow because it's about metabolism. As new information comes out, new information gets, put into the equation, right? So calories in, calories out doesn't work. Healthcare professionals responded, why? Because, what I do and my team does, we try to teach a systemic way to understand your body. How does it work together? And it be medically founded, not just be a bunch of, I think it works this way. So what is it that affects your health? If you had to say over your lifetime, what is it that's affecting your health? It's obviously diet, right? And of course, people go, oh, no, man, I'm a 40-40-30 guy. It's all zone. No, it's not zone. It's Atkins. No, it's not Atkins. South Beach. No, it's not South Beach. It's Scarsdale. No, it's not Scarsdale. Scarsdale, that dates me. Wow. It's not that. I'm eating the Omni diet. No, I'm not doing the Omni diet. I'm doing the Paleo diet. No, I'm not doing the Paleo diet. I'm doing the Neo-Paleo, Metro-Paleo diet because I don't really go out and run after my animals. So it's a Metro-Paleo diet, and I don't really – my Paleo diet, when I say that, my Paleo folks always go, that's a mean, very mean-spirited comment, right? No, just putting out a point that, when you go, everybody says they're Paleo, well, do you go out and dig your root vegetables up and eat the dirt that's on those vegetables? Because you know what? If you're not, you're missing the micronutrients, and hey, and then the whole Paleo theory got blown up the other day because of all the imaging studies on Paleo, man, showing they had every bit as much plaque as we do. So, done with that. What are we going to do now, right? So, and I actually am in favor of lower, like when you look at it, I'm in favor of lower carbohydrate diets for most people, because most people in our culture are insulin resistant. 70% of our people are overweight, 33% are obese. The majority, the big driver of that is that I don't process glucose good, and that's why that diet works for you. But it doesn't fix the problem. It doesn't fix it. There's other reasons why you're insulin resistant. That's what you got to get to. So, diet is a big deal. Genetics is a big deal. Look, I weigh 225 pounds. I am 5 feet 11. I have a 12 triple E foot. All right? 14 ring finger. I would say I have a large skeletal frame. Some people say more like Neanderthalic, but I'd say more just a large skeletal frame. And so my point is when I go up against the BMI chart, I am morbidly obese. So our genetics dictate things. How else do genetics dictate things? My family, I am the only surviving 53-year-old male who was not a diabetic in my family on my father's side. And we're a big Italian family. I mean, there's a lot of 50-year-old Italians in my lineage. You know, big immigrant family, a lot of them, everybody's diabetic. All right? It's written, if we turn the light out, it'll, like, and if we get a black light in here, it'll say, will be diabetic. It's going to come. It's happening. Right? My grandmother, what got me into this really from the earliest day is when my grandmother, I would run in to see my grandmother. I only got to see her once a year. And she was a fingerless, toeless, blind diabetic. And so how she would see me grow, which she'd say, Jimmy, get up here, right? I'd have to walk up to her and I'd be 6 years old and I'd see the big cataracts on her eyes. And then I'd see her bring up her hand without the fingers and she'd want to feel my face, right? Well, you know, I love my grandmother. My grandmother was fantastic. But as a six-year-old, it's a little stressful, right? You're like, I don't want that to happen to me, right? I don't want that happening to me. And then I've watched my father as a diabetic for the last 42 years. You know, I've been diabetic. Been around a lot. Brother, diabetic, you know. So genetics play a big role. Do you have an ApoE SNP? If you're an ApoE3 SNP and you have a couple other genes, you're 13 times more likely to get Parkinson's than somebody that doesn't have that SNP. Wow, 13-fold risk, right? So genes play a role. Do we really know a lot about gene expression yet? No. Because you know what? There's a bunch of genes playing all at one time, right? It's like they're playing a chord in your body. So we don't really know what these single gene variants mean. But we do know it's important. We can't say that it's not important. We just don't. We know more about the future is going to be in the metabolomic expression of this stuff. Prescription drugs. I wrote databases on drug nutrient depletion. A lot of you, if you heard of the statin medications like Lipitor, those kind of drugs, they deplete CoQ enzyme Q10. Or when you go to get a diuretic prescription like hydrochlorothiazide, it'll say it depletes potassium, right? Well, there's a lot of people, if you go get a medication, go to get medication. Somebody just gave you medication. Doctor says, here, you need this. You are too cheerful. I'm giving you a downer. You gotta balance your mood out, man. You're just too happy. So, yeah, you know, it's true. I could tell. You really need to frown more. So he takes the medication. Now, if he doesn't say to his doctor within a week, I've got this rash and it's over 50% of my body and it's really itchy and feels bad. What do you think it is? Adverse event, right? I had a reaction to the drug. Or, I don't know why my tongue is this big, doctor. Is that thumping that I did? A histaminic reaction, right? But if he takes that drug for a year or 2 years or 3 years and another symptom takes place, another condition comes up, does the doctor look at that drug as being causal? They don't. What we've spent the last 22 years doing is searching on databases looking at drug-induced nutrient depletion. Give you a great example. If you take a diuretic called hydrochlorothiazide and you're given it, a lot of times if people have either metabolic syndrome, they're hypertensive or pre-hypertensive, and they're going to give them this light diuretic. It's, you know, they have it in containers, 50-gallon drums. They give so much of this stuff out, right? I mean, this is a very common drug. It depletes, in addition to potassium, it'll say eat a banana and drink orange juice. Well, that's kind of good if you're pre-diabetic. Eat a banana and drink a glass of orange juice at the same time. But if you're not, if you're going to do that, okay. But the other thing that happens is they don't put a sticker on there that says it depletes magnesium. And interestingly, and when you deplete magnesium out of your body, and estimates are about 80% of the U.S. population is deficient in magnesium already anyway, as you deplete magnesium, it's the number one nutrient associated with developing type 2 diabetes. So in that pre-diabetic person, I gave them a medication to help their blood pressure go away, you know, go down. But at the same time, I gave them a drug that progressed them to their diabetes. That's polypharmacy, right? It's what you hear about when you read about pharmacy. And I'm pro-drug, okay, guys? I'm not telling you all drugs are bad. Drugs have saved my father's life. They saved my brother's life. I've got all, every day I've seen it happen. But you know what they're not really good at? Drug therapy doesn't do a good job of helping you live a healthy life. What it does help you do, if you choose not to live a healthy life, it'll help you live with the symptoms of not living a healthy life. Right? I don't want to, you know what? I know I need to take in more antioxidants. The chicken wings I ordered, it's got the high antioxidant sauce on it. I ordered it that way. Right? So it's not, and I'm being very, obviously I'm glossing over this. There are heroic situations where drugs save lives. But when I'm talking about chronic hypertension, and in many cases hyperlipidemia, and in many cases insulin resistance, it's known that when you change your diet, that you can improve your glucose utilization and your pre-diabetes better than drug therapy. They've done head-to-head trials, right? So that's what we got to get to. What else? Do I exercise? You know, it's interesting. Hopefully I'll get to those slides. That people can exercise too much. It's very popular right now for people to overtrain as if they're going to be in the Olympics. And you're really just trying to beat the person next to you in your spinning class. It's not the Olympics. You're not doing this for a living. You know what? You know, there's a fine line between training, moderate exercise, and intense exercise. And when you cross over to intense, it actually starts to cause problems, not solve problems. All right? Same thing. Spiritual base, I just happen to think that it's incredibly important that people get connected to greater, something greater than themselves. I mean, however you want to do it, good. I don't have a particular preference. I just say, you know what? There's something more important than you. Why don't you try serving a little bit? And I bet you'll feel really good about yourself. And then the other one is, what diseases do you have or did you have? You know, somebody will say, oh, yeah, well, you know, I was treated with antibiotics for 15 years, and I just got off of them. You think that could have something to do with me, not feeling the way I feel? Yeah, you know, you spent 10, 15 years on a drug, and you just went off of it. It doesn't mean it's, you know, your body just automatically set back to normal. In fact, it'll tend to not go back to normal. And then, of course, two big ones, environmental exposures. Look, we don't have a clue what we're getting exposed to. I mean, don't believe me. Just go to the EPA's website, right? We track about 1,000 chemicals, and there's 88,000 of them in our environment. So, you know, and we only track about 600, you know, for physiologic adverse events. So we really don't know. It's a soup. I'm not trying to be, Greenpeace or PETA or anything else here. I'm just trying to tell you the facts. Environmentally, if you look at all of the major journals, they're pointing at this as a major cause of diabetes. The American Heart Association has said that environmental quality is a primary cause of heart disease now, that it contributes to heart disease. Diabetes with petrochemicals, phthalates, arsenic, both indicated for causing diabetes and insulin resistance. And then my favorite one that we're going to talk a lot about tonight is stress. Because what we tend to do today is we live a really fast-paced life. I'm good at it. I mean, I still have trouble typing. Like, I feel really deficient in my texting and emailing skills on my phone, and that stresses me out. I haven't won a competition yet. And where's it all lead you? Here's the point. This is what I hear. Oh, I've heard this now, honestly, I'm not kidding, almost 30 years. I started in practice doing this kind of work at age 25, 53, 28 years, all right? Yeah, so I want you guys to do this for me. Count up how many of these you have, and I'm going to ask you just a couple questions. And then just, you know, if you feel like raising your hand, you can raise it like this high. Or if you're proud of them, you know, wave them up and down. So, fatigue. I don't have the energy or vitality I think I should. Midday energy crash, 2 o'clock. Now, it doesn't count if you go for a quad Americano and then double it, right? Or if you go and get a triple latte and add super sugar in it. Now, what's really cool, it's great because now I can get single espressos because they've got those caffeine sprinkles now they just released at Starbucks. Have you guys seen the caffeine sprinkles yet? You haven't? You got to ask for those. Those things are the bomb. They don't have those. So midday energy crash, 2 o'clock, bam, done, 2 to 3 o'clock. Insomnia or lack of sleep? Here's how I'm going to define it. You have trouble getting to sleep or you wake up in the middle of the night and you do not sleep 7 to 9 hours a night. One of those three criteria, and you have to click that box. Next one, weight around the belly. I've got belly fat. I'm achy. I hurt. I'm foggy headed. Short-term memory loss. When I talked to lifetime fitness trainers, 40% of people under the age of 30, this is a qualitative survey, but I had everybody raise your hands. 1,000 people I surveyed on these things. About 40% of them said they have short-term memory loss already. I was shocked. You know, I mean, I know here in L.A., no, it's anxious and worried. I feel overcommitted. I'm anxious and worried. I feel emotionally flat. I'm feeling burned out or I'm feeling cravings. All right. How many people have 3 of those? Raise their hand. How many people have 4 of those? Raise their hand. Own that, man. Good. And how many people have more than 4? Raise your hand. How many people had less than 3? I had 6 people in the room. Whew. Okay, now that I've got everybody in a really good mood. So what's your metabolism then? What have I been trying to get across to people? Is that your metabolism, It's dynamic. Like what you have going on in your body right now, the chemistry that's going on right now is dynamic. It is changing and you can change it. You cannot change the fact that you're aging. We're all going to age, but how vitally can we age? How good can we feel as we age, right? I mean, you know, that's how good can we look? How good can we feel? All that I'm up for. So this is what I like to think about. When you think about metabolism, don't think about, well, I have a slow metabolism or I have a fast metabolism. Because I got to tell you, when I have people breathe into their little meters, people, big fat people and little skinny people only have a couple hundred calorie difference in their metabolisms a lot of time. It isn't like they're burning big different amounts. That's not it, all right? So it's the sum total of all the chemical reactions driving your chemistry either towards health or disease. Do you have a loved one? Or have you had this happen to you where you were going along fine with your health? And then one day, it was like the wheels came off the cart. One day, I started to ache. And after I started to ache, I started to notice my mood started to go. And then I was told that I had plaque in my arteries. And then I was told I was pre-diabetic. Have you ever had anybody that you know that kind of they were going along fine? Or let's even be more dramatic. My father. 82-year-old guy, when he was 79, this guy, he could run circles around people half his age, but he's belching. And I'm also noticing when he's going to his internist and I'm seeing his blood tests that his red blood cells are going down and his hemoglobin's going down, and I'm going, oh, you got some kind of bleed, more than likely because you're older and we should think about that. And his doc was like, let's give him some iron. I think that's what it is. But the reality is that what ended up happening is he had a duodenal ulcer. I finally, got upset enough. Not an ulcer, I'm sorry. He had a duodenal cancer. He had a cancer of the duodenum, an adenocarcinoma, very rare, like 0.25% of cancers, I think, are duodenal cancers. But got it on a scope. But you know what? He went from vital. I mean, just the man. I'm looking at him going, I can be half of my father when I'm that age. I'm going to be just fine. Right? 6 months. Now, because of his vitality and he does take care of himself, he had what's called a Whipple surgery, which is a pretty traumatic surgery. It's one that a lot of people half his age don't survive. They take a lot of your inside of your intestine out and your stomach and the head of your pancreas. He survived that. It's 3 years later. He's doing best practices for his health. He gets out and walks. He exercises. He tries to eat right. And you know what? He's 82. He's doing great, right? But it's that thing of these things can come up on you fast. The more you prepare, the less you have that risk. Does it guarantee anything? No. Doesn't guarantee anything, right? Because we've got all these environmental pollutants hanging out. We've got all kinds of stuff that's hanging out. So understanding what the disruptors to your current metabolism and how it performs leads to strategies to cut off excess inflammatory signaling. When you talk to anybody, you know, if you talk to leading, folks in the integrative medicine space, they would say that oxidative stress or inflammation, right? You hear about silent inflammation on the cover of Newsweek, is what ages us and causes damage to our body. Well, I got to get control of it. Oxidative stress. Sex hormones. As we age, our sex hormones start to falter on us. If you're a man and your testosterone's dropping, you know, it's more than, well, you know, I can't, you know, my erectile function isn't good anymore. I'm beginning to get erectile dysfunction, which is a very important medical sign if something's wrong. But more importantly, it's their mood's dropping, they're losing bone density, they're more at cardiovascular risk. There's a lot going on when that drops in them. Women too, right? When women enter menopause, they have the same cardiovascular risk, actually slightly elevated over men, and because of hormone changes. Stress hormone balance is important for aging. Glucose and insulin important. How your immune system functions important. Am I able to get rid of stuff? If I'm breathing stuff in and I've got the environment, can I get rid of it? And then, you know, what do I have a nutrient-rich diet? Yeah, I get the chicken wing sauce. I get the antioxidant chicken wing sauce. It's very nutrient rich. This is our big, you know, this is kind of the big thing that's going on, right? I mean, let's look. This is obesity trends from 1990 to 2008. So look at the blue, right? White, we didn't have data because mainly none of the moose were reporting here in the central state here. The moose didn't have to get surveyed. There was no ballots there. In Nevada, it was the sand people. So here we don't have it. Here, take a look what happens by 1998. And then now take a look at by 2008, where as high as 30% of the population is considered to be obese. This is just in, you know, 20 years. Now, I'll challenge people all day long because they'll say, oh, the food. Hey, people were eating Wonder Bread in 1950. Right? People were eating apple pie in 1950. I mean, and I'm not saying everybody should go out and eat Wonder Bread and apple pie. That's how you're going to get well. I want to be on record for that, right on the camera. So everybody gets it clear. I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is it's more than just what we're eating. We do need to eat more whole foods. All you got to do if you read anything about the Mediterranean diet and, you know, longevity, we know that having lots of vegetables, is a good thing. Right? I think that's the one thing I can get every diet to agree on. Oh, yeah, vegetables. They're important. They're important. Other than the ice cream and tuna fish diet. The ice cream and tuna fish diet, which was a real diet. It was a real diet. You can have all the ice cream you want, and you can eat all the tuna fish you want. I don't know why people didn't stay on it very long. I mean, you know, the first week, it's great, right? At least for the ice cream part. So here's what I'm talking about on trends. This is a very important study that came out of Kaiser Permanente. 46,578 members of the Kaiser Permanente Northwest program had fasting glucose levels less than 100. That means they were normal. And, okay, a 99 or less means you're okay. And this was done from 1997, and it was done over actually 10 years, and they enrolled them between 97 and 2000, and they did not have diabetes, and they didn't have any kind of problems with insulin resistance. And then they were put in categories. See the categories? Under 85, 85 to 89, 90 to 94, 95 to 99. And then they were followed until they developed diabetes, died, which is a terrible way to leave a study. In my opinion, anyway, it's like, you know, and then, or they left their health care plan, and then they studied those folks until 2007. What did they find out? And I'm paraphrasing this. I could go through all the data, but I just want to kind of, I'm making a point here. These are all normals. Normal people. They all got normal glucoses, right? For every rise in glucose of 1 point above 84 was correlated. Now remember, this is a 47,000 person study. This isn't a little, well, we studied 34 people and 12 mice. You know, this is a big study. 1 point above 84 correlates to a 6% increased rise in developing type 2 diabetes. So when people have a 96 glucose, right? 96, let me see, 84, 96, 6, 12, 12, 12 times 6, oh my God, that's 72. I got a 72% chance of being a diabetic in the next decade. You know what you're told when you get a 96 glucose when you go into your doctor? You're normal. Remember the call I told you about? Everything's normal. You're normal, normal, normal. Wouldn't you want to know where you're at on your odds? Don't you want to understand where your trend is going? That's what metabolic medicine is about. That's what understanding, where am I going? This study is just one of the studies. There's a lot of them coming out now, finally. It's a lot that I've tracked over the years. I've talked about this for at least a decade, actually, of this issue before the study even came out. But this is a big issue because you know what the biggest cause of plaque on your arteries is? Why you plaque your arteries? It's blood sugar fluctuation. It's called postprandial hyperglycemia. Look it up. Don't believe me. Get on the web and look. Put in postprandial hyperglycemia as a cause for heart disease. And you know what that means is how badly your blood sugar fluctuates is plaquing your arteries. Now, you want to know another great statistic? You guys probably know the answer to this. What's the first sign of a heart attack 50% of the time? 50% of the time, what is it? Is it left hand? Is it? Left arm. That's death. Death is the first sign of a heart attack 50% of the time. Death. So, you know, so people don't want to hear about, if I start to, in our institute, I gave people, you know, big love, right? But it was a scary Italian love. Like, come on, you don't want to plaque your arteries, right? Come on. You really want to go down that path? You understand what this means? Because truthfully, and this, I just did a survey with doctors on diet, and unless somebody comes in that's morbidly obese, you know what a lot of times doctors will say they're uncomfortable with? Telling somebody who's 15 or 20 pounds overweight that they need to lose weight. They feel uncomfortable with that. I'm like, what? I mean, why would you be uncomfortable? If it's weight, especially here, visceral, you know, kind of central fat, adiposity, that's the weight that says you've got problems in your glucose. All right? So it's a big deal. Where else does it lead? This book, Diabetes and Cancer, Epidemiologic Links, or Epidemiologic Evidence and Molecular Links. I got to write a chapter in this book, and I was really fortunate because this guy right here, Dr. Kurt Zenker, I mean, PhD, MD, immunology, oncology, this gentleman, he just a real mentor. Just unbelievable. Unbelievable mind. And the fact is, and it's all out. We published this three or four years ago, I think, at this point. And you're kind of hearing it now in the literature, right? Women who have higher blood sugars are more risk for breast cancer. People who have intestinal cancers, you know, if you're diabetic or pre-diabetic, you have a higher risk of having intestinal cancer. So when your blood sugars are off, it's not just you're going to plaque your arteries. The other fact is that you're going to be more prone to get cancer. And a lot of people don't connect that. And I've got something. We're going to stick everybody's finger after this and look at their blood sugar. No, we're not going to do that. I probably should have did that. So why else is glucose important? It's been associated with Alzheimer's. In fact, it's now called, Alzheimer's is being called diabetes type 3 in the literature. So I know I'm making your night tonight. You guys probably wonder how many people know their blood sugars. You know your blood sugars. Great. How many people have a blood sugar under 90 fasting? All right. Good. Great. Cortisol and Alzheimer's. So cortisol, the stress hormone, we're going to talk about that in just a minute. But cortisol, which elevates your what's called your hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, when I'm under stress, it's like, for lack of a better way of saying it, you're frying the circuits in your brain. You think of a circuit board in your brain, and you're surging too much energy through it, all right? Cortisol is what does that. So cortisol is what your body lets, and of course it also leads to, gaining belly fat and all kinds of other good things. But the big thing with this is that it leads. So now, interesting, what else does elevated cortisol do? It raises your blood sugar. When you have to fight a white tiger, your body needs to put glucose into the bloodstream, right? I got to fight a white tiger. But the white tiger is, my email just crashed. I can't believe this traffic getting down here. And we went the wrong way on the freeway. For real. We did go the wrong way on the freeway. I was really stressed out. You could ask the person driving. I was sitting in the passenger seat, absolutely coming unglued as I was snoring, right? So how should your stress hormones be? This is how it works, guys. I mean, look, and people would say I'm a night owl. Okay, so your stress hormones are really off. That's why people, when you listen to people about that they're night shift workers, and you hear in the news all the time, oh, they have higher mortality for all causes. It's because we weren't meant. Our brain was not meant to be awake at night. So how it works is your brain wakes up with daylight, and your brain takes in darkness through your eye and says, it's getting dark. You can shut down those stress hormones now. But you know what we do? I'm going to work 3 more hours. And then I got to stop at the store. And after I stop at the store, I gotta go, I gotta help my son or my daughter with their homework. And after I do that, I've gotta watch Dancing with the Stars. My gosh, it's a new season. And then after, when I get in the house and it's dark, I'm gonna make sure I turn every light on so my mind thinks that it's light again. Right? So your body works on a circadian rhythm. You release stress hormones in the day, in the morning, peaking at about 7 a.m., 8 a.m., unless you get that Venti Starbucks with the caffeine sprinkles, and it peaks whenever you drink that. But otherwise, it peaks, and then it actually starts to decline afternoon. And by evening, it should be starting to really wane, because at night, when we get down here at like 10 p.m., that's when your body's supposed to be releasing melatonin. And melatonin is what repairs your brain. It doesn't just tell your brain to go to sleep. And when your brain goes into deep sleep, all the vesicles, all the neurotransmitters have to refill. That's all good stuff, right? But what happens when I stay up till midnight instead of going to bed? And then I get up early, I have less hours sleep, right? What's the effect of that? They've measured that now. How many people sleep 7 to 9 hours of uninterrupted sleep a night? Wow, you guys are a good crowd. Like a third of you actually are sleeping. That's good. That's good. So, your brain gets perceived stress. Your brain does not know whether you're running a marathon in a traffic jam or having a white tiger chase you. And the difference is, think about it. When a white tiger was chasing you, if it did, would you ever last 26 miles of a tiger chasing you? You would be a really fast runner if you could do that. No, what was it? What did you do? You turned and you fought. You had all these stress hormones to be superhuman and fight that tiger off, kill the tiger, climb up a tree, run to a cave, or be lunch. It's one of the four things. It's real easy. But what do? Our brain instead takes on a 14-hour day thinking a white tiger is coming after it. And then what's it do after that? Well, I go to the gym. And then I train. Okay. Wow. So it's starting to identify. People will say, I'm not stressed. And I'd always, the big thing for me to find out if somebody was stressed is when I come back in the room, I slam the door and see if they really jump high. You know, if they really jumped high, I knew they were stressed. No. But the other big one is interrupted sleep. If you're waking up at 3 in the morning, you have an interrupted sleep cycle, and it's due to low melatonin. And that means when people have trouble sleeping at night or they can't get to sleep at night, it means your brain took on so much stress from the day. It's called hyperarousal. You could have apnea. That's different, right? If you've got an obstruction, it's a different thing. But I'm talking about you're laying in bed going, or you've done this. It's 9 o'clock at night, and you're at the couch. And the couch, you're doing this. You're going, you really want to watch Winona Judd dancing. Well, not really, but you kind of want to do it. But you're going like this, and you're sleeping on the couch. And then you get up, and you go to bed. And you lay in bed, and you go, oh, man, I got so much work to do tomorrow. I can't believe what I got to get done. I'm going to have to get the Rolodex out because I got at least 15 tasks that I didn't get done today that I got to get done tomorrow. Afterwards, I got about five more, and if I do the five more, I'm going to have to do about seven more. Then I'm going on vacation in about 6 months. I really should start planning about what I'm going to wear. Anybody ever do – that's probably rare. Oh, you do that? Yeah, it's very rare. You and only like 100 million other Americans. 60% of Americans will have trouble with sleep, you know, in any given year. On a chronic basis, that tells you something about culturally what's going on. Or I have my phone. I mean, there was a guy that came to me and he had what they thought was what's called a viral dysphonia. No pun intended, but dysphonia means lost his voice, right? Paralyzed the vocal cord, lost his voice, crackling as soon as he gets three or four words out. Oh, it's viral, it's viral, it's viral. I said, well, what about your lifestyle? Let's talk about that. Well, I'm a trader, and he was in New York. I said, well, do you sleep with a phone by your bed? No, I sleep with four phones by my bed. Do you, I'm not going to ask if you answer him. Of course I answer him. He didn't sleep all night long. He's trading all night long. Okay. Gee, I wonder why your voice went out, because there is something called stress-induced dysphonia. It was like the guy came to us that was a big-time baseball player, all-star. Had bad GI, bad, incredible GI problems. They're scanning this guy, scoping him up, scoping him down. The team doctor sends him to our place, and he said, I'll go to the quack. Nobody else is figuring out what's going on, because in Ohio I was pretty quacky. And the first thing I asked him was, well, tell me what you do. How do you start your day? Well, I eat five bowls of cereal. What do you do after you eat five bowls of cereal? Well, I drink three Red Bulls on the way into the field, the baseball field. I said, what do you do when you're at the baseball field? Well, I drink, how do you hydrate? Well, I drink Mellow Yellow. Really? How much Mellow Yellow do you drink? Because Mellow Yellow was in the water cooler. You know, you could hit the button and the water just came out Mellow Yellow. I said, hey, how many of those do you do? He's doing this. And I'm going, okay. 32. You had to come to me, and I had to come in on a Saturday because you didn't want anybody to see you when you're in my office because you're this big star. And I have to tell you, don't drink 32 Mellow Yellows a day because your stomach's going to hurt. Nobody can figure that one out. Nobody bothered to ask you, your stomach's hurting, what are you eating? This is the story, right? So what do we talk about is this chronic stress piece is a big, important area. I kind of talked about this in craving already. When you get under chronic stress, your serotonin pool starts to drop. And that's when you start to get anxious. And when your serotonin drops, your melatonin drops. And when your melatonin drops, it interrupts your sleep. And you'll start to feel flat. Also, what happens is I get under a lot of stress. As my cortisol goes up, I lose a building block hormone called DHEA. Now, what's scary about that, when you scan people's brains, my facility in Ohio, we have MRIs, we do functional imaging, all kinds of cool stuff. And when somebody has high cortisol, and they're losing their pro-hormone that builds all their sex hormones, you know what happens to your brain? It shrinks. The hippocampus shrinks. And you know what that means? You have short-term memory loss. You get short-term memory loss under chronic stress. And what they found is as long as your DHEA pool was high, it protected you against it. But when your DHEA pool dropped out and your cortisol was high, that's when people started going, what's my name again? Right? I always ask him. This is the telltale sign. I always say, I use very technical terms when I'm talking to people. It really works that way. I say, are you feel like you're pushing a thought through Jell-O? That's exactly it. I know your processing speed, right? You feel like you just can't get it out quick enough. So these are just the things that kind of lead us to all these issues. Stress that leads to increased cortisol induces food cravings, and stress contributes to abdominal obesity. All right? So when you're under stress, remember I said you can be under stress and you can gain weight, and you could be doing the perfect diet and gaining weight. Perfect. And this is what a lot of people experience in that lifetime model. Subjects that averaged 4 hours of sleep, less leptin, higher ghrelin, their hunger went up, and guess what? They had cravings for carbs, sweets, salty, starchy, high-caloric snacks. 4 hours of sleep, I'm getting that. 1,000 volunteers, 5 hours of sleep, less leptin, more ghrelin, and their BMI went up 3.6%. They got fat. That's Stanford School of Medicine, right? Wow. Just not sleeping makes me fat. The Hainesville Gangwish N. Haines data found subjects that averaged 5 hours sleep a night had a 73% increased likelihood of obesity over those that slept 7 to 9 hours a night. 73% increased likelihood. So if those of you who are sleeping 7 to 9 hours sleep uninterrupted, you've got one checkbox that you can go, you know what, I'm helping my metabolism. Those of you who are saying I'm only sleeping 5 hours a night because I choose to, because I want to watch Winona Judd dance, and I want to make sure that I can get up early to talk to my plants, get into my Birkenstocks, get my nubbies on, and then do my yoga, but I'm going to cheat my sleep, not a good idea. Do not cheat your sleep. Figure out how you can do all those other cool things. I got nubby Birkenstocks. I like wheatgrass. I like all that stuff. But I'm saying there are basic things that people still not do in our culture that are really important for health, and we're still looking for a magic bullet or a magic herb, right? Nobody gets a Lipitor deficiency. Nobody gets a ginkgo deficiency. Let's be fair. On either side of or let's get the latest goji berry or Tibetan mango fermented with, monkey, whatever, right? I mean, we hear all these crazy, cool things, and, hey, they could be really valid, but you know what we got to do? We got to get some sleep. We got to get the stress out. Nobody's ever felt like that, right? Right? I wish this would play, but it's not transferring from my Mac to the PC. This was a house episode, and basically she came in and said, my asthma's not working. And he said, really? Or my asthma medication. Why? I don't know. Real educated, real nice looking, right? Because you can't assume that somebody knows something just because they dress nice. She goes, it's not working. And Hal says, well, let's take a look. Get your medication out. Let me see how it works. It was an inhaler, right? Inhaler. She shakes it up and she goes, tsst. You got to know how things work. If you got to understand how your body works. You got to understand that. So more interesting things. Interrupted sleep. Symptoms of depression, anxiety, sleep disturbances, and psychosomatic illness possibly correlated with your waist to hip ratio. Basically, the heavier you are, the less happy you are most of the time. I'm not going to say in everyone, but depression is one of the big things that, kind of cause the rate of recidivism in people that are overweight trying to get their weight down. Interrupted sleep right here reduces your fatty acid oxidation. I don't burn fats as much as 52%. Small study, but, 52% less fat burning when I lower sleep. So everybody will say, well, God, I really want to burn some fat. Great, sleep some more. What? No way! So, what's this doing to our brains? I mean, I really want to emphasize this to you guys. I don't have a lot of time, and I wish I did, but I feel like I got to get this across to people because, I can tell you about all kinds of botanicals and their mechanisms of action and what's really hot and new, but you know what? People still aren't doing really basic things, and we got to get the basics down. And so the hippocampus is basically the area of your brain where repeated stress damages it. And cortisol is really involved, and I won't get too far into it. I'll explain it off of this slide. You see this little radio called glial-like stem cell. This is a stem cell. And this has to mature to create neurons. We can grow neurons as we get older. We can keep our brain growing and budding. That's actually, we didn't know that. We know that now. But you know what stops this? Stress hormones and lack of sleep. You do not regenerate your neurons, and you only have so many. You know, you want to save them, right? Sleep and stress suppresses adult neurogenesis. Neurogenesis is stem cell to a matured neuron, right? So stress interferes with all stages of neuronal renewal and inhibits proliferation and survival. When I'm under stress, I'm not managing it. I'm not going to take any behavioral techniques, even autonomic breathing, right? Deep autonomic breathing, right? You can do that. There's all kinds of techniques. But if I'm not going to take any kind of steps to manage my cortisol, or better yet, why not measure your cortisol? Executives come in, I measure their cortisol. It's at, time and a half higher than it should be. I make a real excessive ones, like a bulimic anorexic young girl. Her cortisol will be triple normal, right? Because she's actually getting an excitatory response from the bulimic activity. And she has her body under a chronic fight or flight response, right? And so they characteristically will have super high cortisols. So this is how your body works. And it's a circuit board, right? I told you to think about a circuit board. Stress affects your brain, the hypothalamus. It tells your spinal cord to release, epinephrine, norepinephrine, or adrenaline, and more cortisol-releasing hormone. What does that do? It changes the permeability in your gut. Why I got into, putting these slides in here is to start to connect the fact that when I get under stress and these chemistries start to shift in my body, now it starts to affect other areas of my body. So my gut, if you look here, it says permeability of the bowel. So how many of you have a food allergy that you know of? Does anybody have a food allergy that they know of? Did you have it since birth, or did you acquire it as an adult? Do you have one that you kind of just figured out? Had it since birth. So there's a lot of people that will have food allergies. They're like, hey, I ate peanut butter as a kid. I ate Jif by the jar full as a kid. But now I've got a peanut allergy. How can I have a peanut allergy now when I ate Jif as a kid? Because as your gut gets more permeable, it gets more allergic, meaning the foods that you present it can become more prone to become sensitive to, and you get an antigen burden, so you get more allergic. The older we get, the more our gut breaks down, just naturally, the more we're prone towards this side of our immune system heating up. And it makes sense, because when I'm more antigenic, I don't fight off bugs as well. What takes out older people? Flu bugs. Why? Because their immune system doesn't fight it off anymore. Flus aren't a leading cause of death in people under the age of 40. They're a leading cause of death in people once they pass 65. All right? So this is what happens with your nervous system, right? Here it is. This is how you're supposed to respond to a stress. Okay, I had an event. A tiger chased me, and I'm going to have to recover, right? You guys have had this. You avoided a traffic accident. You felt the adrenaline. You shook. You felt your stomach get queasy. And then over a period of time, what happened? Okay, it's gone. I'm back to myself now. Now what happens? I got to get up. Oh, my God, I'm late. I overslept. I got to make breakfast for my kid, and I got to pack lunch. Oh, I've got my report that I forgot to print off. I just saw the traffic report. The 101 and the 85 are both backed up. Oh, I got this meeting I got to get to tonight. Oh, my manager's is getting on my case because I didn't get my report in on time. Oh, repeated insults. What happens then? Your body can no longer adapt. Here's why this is important. This is a normal cortisol pattern. High in the morning, low into the night. This is cortisol measured by saliva, right? This is somebody who's a little stressed out. Their cortisol's high morning to night. This is somebody who probably doesn't have any cortisol left to give because they've been so stressed out for such a long period of time, They're not capable of producing it anymore. When this flattens, when your cortisol curve flattens, there was something called the Cardia study in 2006. I think I have the slide in here. Let me get to it. Here's a great sign of stress. 2008. 8 years later. Look at that. Look. Wow. And he had a heart bypass. Let's see. What was the slide? Cardiovascular disease and cortisol. Let's go to why. I think I have the cardio. It's not working. There it is. Cardio study, 2006. Persons with a cortisol slope score in the flattest quartile had the greatest likelihood of any coronary calcium than did those with the remaining quartiles, adjusted for smoking and diabetes and blood pressure and everything else. Meaning that, remember this thing right here I showed you, that as you get under stress, right, you start to erode this? When you start to erode your ability to respond to the stress, you start to flatten your curve. The flatter your slope, like if you're jacked up all day long, basically, that's the person that's more prone to calcify their arteries. Cortisol causes bone mineral density loss. You mobilize calcium from your bone into your bloodstream, and you can look. Once again, please don't believe a thing I'm telling you. Whatever hits you, look it up. Right? When you mobilize bone mineral density loss is directly associated with coronary calcification. So the more you lose bone, the more you calcify your arteries. Very directly correlated. All right, we get past President Clinton here. Poor, look at that. Yeah. Now, so you think it's just the people under stress. Hair samples obtained from 304 amateur endurance athletes, 190 females, 114 males, average age 38 years old with 70 controls. Hair cortisol was measured. Self-reported volume of exercise, on average, 42% higher cortisol in endurance athletes. I was talking to someone on the way in here, and they saw the same observations, that their endurance athletes were neurotic, they were obsessive, they had a lot of, you know, they had a lot of really, you know, irritable bowel, you know, a lot of times high correlation of irritable bowel with endurance athletes. Take a look at their cortisol. So cycling, this is a 10K run, half marathon, triathlon, marathon, up to 70% higher. Look at their volume on runners, how much it goes up based on their running. Now, I got to tell you, I've got thousands of people that I've talked to on this, and I've reviewed a lot of data on this from my experience with Lifetime Fitness. This runs true. You know what the interesting thing is that when cortisol goes up, your heart rate goes up. And so if you talk to you know, run, I mean, I'm talking elite people, like go to Ironman Kona, right, or finish the Leadville 100. These are big, tough endurance events. And these folks are sidelined with tachycardia because as soon as they start running, their heart rate goes up real high. Why? Because they have an inappropriate cortisol response that they've trained, and they think they're running from a white tiger right away, and their heart rate goes up right away. They can't control it anymore. The other thing that happens is they get runner's diarrhea. And they get runner's diarrhea because, remember, cortisol causes a change in bowel permeability. It changes the kind of the osmolality of the gut. And so they get runner's diarrhea, and it literally sidelines them. I mean, Olympic athletes, it sidelines them. So it's not, what my point to this is, it's just not the person that is fat and overweight, stressed out. It's just not the person that's in a very high important position that's stressed out. We also can do it to ourselves. And the person could look quite healthy. And, you know, look, guys, all you got to do is read about it. People die of marathon runs just about at every race. So, interesting stuff. That's a little too technical. We'll go past that one. Let's go past that one. So, I'll just do a couple more slides here, and then I'm going to open it up for questions. I can talk later. I don't know even how long I'm supposed to talk. As you can tell, I'm not short on words. So, I talked about your adrenal glands and stress And then also the factors that influence your health that you got to get a, you got to get a grip on, right? It's like, what's my diet like? Am I being true to myself? What's my exercise like? What's my rest time like? Are there things I could do to reduce my exposures? What kind of household cleaners am I using, right? Am I venting my dry cleaning? If you're not going to an eco dry cleaner, you should be venting your dry cleaning before you hang it in your house. You should get that bag out in the garage, in the open, hang it up, because guess what? The perchloroethylene that's in that, you take your bag out, and they've shown it dramatically gets into your tissues when you do it. So vent it, right? What steps can I take to change my lifestyle, right? That's important. Now, what affects your gut flora? Why is this so important? Because your gut flora drives how you're going to absorb things, how your immune system is going to function. And so tap water. People say, back in Cincinnati, when I lived in Cincinnati, I just recently had moved. Tap water in Cincinnati, they go, nothing can live in Cincinnati tap water. It is great water. Why? Because it's so high in chlorine. I mean, it's higher than pool water. I mean, it is. I mean, you drink it and you're like, wow, I feel sanitized, right? And your nostrils. You know when you get around chlorine and your nostrils burn? You kind of get a light nostril burn. And so what does chlorine do? It kills bugs. What is chlorine going to do when you drink it? Kill your bugs. You don't want to drink tap water. What else will affect GI flora? Antibiotics. Everybody knows this. A woman takes antibiotics, they get a yeast infection. Why? You kill off the beneficial bugs. You take antibiotics, you disrupt the flora. What else causes GI flora changes? Psychogenic stress. You could do the perfect diet. You ferment your own vegetables and get active cultures. And you actually do it with intention, and you honor the vegetable before you pickle it, right? You're doing all the right stuff to the pickled vegetable. The cauliflower is happy that it's being fermented, all right? But you are just jacked up on stress. Like, because if you don't ferment that for 3.2 days and make sure that at 6:45 a.m. on the fourth day you stir it three rotations to the right and three rotations to the left, psychogenic stress. Get it? All right. What else? Drugs. A lot of categories of drugs. You know what the number two highest selling drug is? They're called proton pump inhibitors. Proton pump inhibitors block acid in your stomach. They also change the flora in your small intestine. They weren't meant to be used for several years. People don't go off of them very often, and they should be on them for 6 to 9 weeks. They're also over-the-counter, things like Pepcid and, you know, those type of drugs, right? They weren't meant to be used for long-term. Those drugs, and then you could think of like ibuprofen, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, steroids, oral contraceptives, whole bunch of different drugs alter the flora of the GI tract. And then, of course, your diet. When I eat a diet high in refined sugars and low in fiber, I grow a different kind of flora. And for women, it's important to understand when you eat a low-fiber diet and you eat a lot of sugar, you make an enzyme in your gut called beta-glucuronidase. So the flora makes this enzyme called beta-glucuronidase. And you know what that does? Your body's supposed to take estrogen, and it's supposed to metabolize it, and it adds something called a glucuronide molecule to it. Bam, right on the estrogen. Now my body can carry it out because I can identify I got a hook to carry it out, glucuronide. You know what happens when I make beta-glucuronidase? I get rid of the hook. What happens to the estrogen? It gets absorbed in your body, and so you become estrogen dominant. What do we know estrogen dominance does? Leads to breast cancer. Exactly. That's why the understanding your whole body metabolism is incredibly important for you to begin to take action. And why am I doing this? Why am I taking fiber? Why is it important to me or not? Right? And then what's it do for us? You know, everything from, you know, cholesterol assimilation, it's anti-carcinogenic, it helps our immune response. Remember, 70% of your immune response is in your intestine. And oh, by the way, when you get allergic, anybody have environmental allergies? Environment, grass, pollens, molds. How do you get allergic? You get allergic by swallowing that, and you have something called antigen-presenting cells in your gut that programs your immune cells everywhere to be reactive to that. So your intestine is important even in environmental allergy development. And this is the big one. I'll finish with this because this is a really big point to understand. This is kind of groundbreaking stuff. A lot of people aren't talking about this yet. But except in the clinical literature, this is like European Journal of Cardiology kind of stuff. This is pretty neat. When I get a leaky gut, remember I talked about stress causing permeability problems? So that's called leaky gut now. Back when I talked about leaky gut in 1988, everybody said, leaky gut, what are you talking about? Swiss cheese in the gut? What? Come on. You know, it's the reality is we do get a leaky gut. And basically proteins can get into our bloodstream and then we can react to those. All right? So what happens? So as my good flora is out, I get a leaky gut. Low-grade endotoxemia. What's that mean? This is probably the, I would say the thing you're going to read about a bunch in the next 12 months. Endotoxemia is you don't have good flora in your gut and you have bad blood perfusion to your intestine. Flora start to die off. Their remnants are called lipopolysaccharides, the cell wall. So part of the cell dies off. It goes into your bloodstream. It's called endotoxin. You know what that does? It attaches to your muscles and your organs, and it triggers inflammation. So why is it important? Let's see. The importance of gastrointestinal system and the pathogenesis of heart failure, European Journal of Heart. Chronic heart failure is a multi-organ disease. Decreased blood perfusion creates intestinal ischemia, alters permeability, and LPS triggers cytokine release from muscle tissue and damages organs. Even heart disease gets worsened when your gut is not healthy. If that's not a whole body concept, right? Because people go, your heart's up here, your belly's down here. Right? I mean, that's how we used to think about medicine. That's how I got, you get taught in pharmacology. I'm, clinical pharmacist. It's like you get taught all these organ systems and what drugs work on the organ system. But I don't get taught the crosstalk between the two. What's going on between my gut and how that's affecting literally the muscle tissue of my heart, right? So that's important. 516 men and women ages 50 to 79 over 5 years, people with lipopolysaccharide levels that were high had triple the risk for atherosclerosis over 5 years. Wow. Right? Smokers and ex-smokers with elevated LPS had a 13-fold risk of heart disease and stroke risk. So the evidence is starting to come out. This is a 2010 study that if your gut, if you're making a lot of endotoxin, you are plaquing your arteries and you're leading to heart disease. You got to take care of your gut. No gas, no bloating, regular bowel movements, eating the right foods, getting fiber, right? We could keep going on and on and on about this, guys. I brought a lot of these slides. But what I'd rather do is just answer some questions for you, because you probably have at least one question. Mic's right here. I think we can just pull that mic. Can we pull this up? Is this working? Here, you can just hand it off.
Thank you.
Sure. Anybody have a question? Go ahead. Oh, I hope I overwhelmed you and got you interested. That was it. Oh, good for you. Good. Metabolic Coat, the question is, it's a lot of information. Is there a resource? There's a couple ways you can do that. Metabolic Code book has a lot of it in it. You could go to, I've got a jimlaval.com website, and I've got newsletters and articles. I got all kinds of stuff there you can get. And it goes through this stuff a little bit at a time or big at a time. And it's not all for fee. I mean, you can get a lot of it there. I just got posted.
Do you have a clinic in San Francisco?
I do not have a clinic in San Francisco. Every city I go to, people ask me that usually. I don't. I wish I did. Yes?
So if you eat a reasonable diet, try to manage your stress, and get good sleep, what are the most beneficial supplements?
So DHEA, I never tell people to do unless they get their blood tested. Because if you do too much DHEA, it can be problems for hormones for men and for women. So always do DHEA under a blood test. What are the key nutrients you should take? Well, first of all, there's real basic things. I mentioned magnesium is deficient in 80% of the U.S. population. I got to tell you, I think it's probably the most important thing I do with people. Fish oils are obviously important. CoQ10 is important in a lot of people because it regulates the about 180 different gene switches in your muscle tissue. It keeps your muscle tissue from aging. You keep what's called type 2A muscle in your muscle tissue, which is young, youthful muscle. I mean, obviously, if you go and get a blood test and you have what's called an MTHFR SNP, which a lot of doctors are working at now, looking at it, you would need methylfolate instead of regular folic acid in order for you to get the benefits of folate because you wouldn't use regular folic acid. So there's a few things that you need to look at and go, well, I probably need to get a test. But I'm a big believer in, you got to get magnesium in. I would try and get B vitamins and vitamin C in because we're under a lot of stress. We use a lot of those up. Get your vitamin D tested. Make sure you get a vitamin D level because it doesn't matter how much you think you're outside. I know up here you guys got a lot of gray days. So that means you're not going to get enough sun. And that means then vitamin D, it's involved in about 4,000 different enzymes in your body. That's how important vitamin D is. So, it's incredibly important. And then if you start thinking about, if I had to go into the botanical category, right? So the legal botanicals. No. If we had to go with botanicals, I would go with aged garlic extract. So aged garlic extract, Dr. Matthew Budoff has studied at UCLA. He's kind of one of the leading interventional cardiologists in the country. I mean, it has been shown to reverse bone mineral density loss. It reduces oxidized LDL, and this is they've done about 700 studies published on aged garlic. In fact, a lot of other garlics use their studies, which really doesn't translate. It also improves endothelial function, meaning the plaquing on your arteries regresses, and they've proven that. And they just finished a fireman study where, firemen are under a lot of stress. And so the stress parameters that were progressing, those firefighters' coronary artery calcification were regressed when they were taking aged garlic extract. So I'm a big fan of aged garlic extract. And I do have no stock in the company, and it's like I just love that particular product. And you don't smell like garlic. When they age it, it gets rid of the volatile compounds out of it, so you don't smell like garlic. And if I had to go past that one, there's a little mushroom. It's actually a fungus called cordyceps, C-O-R-D-Y-C-E-P-S. And cordyceps, I think, it's fantastic because it does a lot of things related to oxygenation of your tissues. And if there's one thing we need to try to do is keep oxygen in our tissues, and it's been fairly well studied, probably 60 or so studies, some in the U.S., some in China. I found incredible value. Endurance and stamina go up. It helps with energy without being a stimulant. So it's a very interesting compound. After I go to that, it's, okay, well, what are your individual needs? Yeah, probiotics are good. Absolutely. I like probiotics a bunch. Yes.
Thank you so much for your talk. I have to wake up maybe within 8 hours, perhaps once or twice, to go to the bathroom. Usually I go back to sleep, but I don't know how bad that is because it is interrupted. And sometimes, occasionally, I have a hard time going back to sleep. And also, I eat usually with dinner one garlic clove. The aged one from a store isn't any better, right?
No, the aged one would have a completely different profile than eating a clove of garlic because the clove of garlic hasn't been aged. When you age it, it changes the chemical properties of it, and that's the stuff that's been studied. And in fact, if you eating one clove of garlic is not a big deal. There's people that eat a bunch of garlic or take a lot of garlic pills. That actually isn't so good to do.
No,
it acts as a prooxidant, not an antioxidant. Prooxidant means it damages your tissues. So you don't want to eat a bunch of raw garlic all the time. That's actually the one clove is not a big deal, but it does not have the same properties as aged garlic extract. It's like when you take cabbage and make it sauerkraut, right? Or grains and make it beer. It has different properties once it's made into that fermentation.
So the raw garlic isn't as beneficial?
Not for heart disease. Not at least there's not the studies that would validate that it is like there is for aged garlic.
and I have low bone density. Is it really?
I wouldn't use aged garlic as a primary thing for low bone density. In your case, I would go to a doctor who's savvy at bone density and should probably look at progesterone, you know, looking at bioidentical progesterone or using strontium ranelate, a mineral.
Oh, I've been given strontium.
Good. That's a good thing for building bone density.
And I have a supplement with calcium, but he said only take up to 300 milligrams of calcium, but there's
right,
other things
in it. Right, because
of
the studies on the plaquenil, right?
Too many people take too much, and that can help calcification.
Well, the biggest problem with calcium is that nobody takes magnesium with it. So the more calcium you take without taking magnesium, you create what's called a thromboembolic risk. It shifts your coagulation, and it shifts your plaqueability. So the real issue, once again, we get snippets in the media, is that we don't take the counterbalance to calcium in our diet.
So there's no way I can not wake up during the night? Is this...
No, I mean, look, here's the thing. I don't want to scare you, but the reality is... I do want to scare you. But no, the reality is sleeping through the night is better than not. If you're getting good rest and you feel rested and your mind is sharp, then you're recovering fine. You may want to think of...
I don't feel rested, though.
Yeah, that's the problem. You may want to think about taking melatonin to at least get you back into a deeper sleep.
I do take melatonin, but I've heard it's not good
Somebody doesn't understand melatonin chemistry. You're okay by taking that.
Is that all right to take
it's fine. Let's go. I'm going to get on to some other questions. Flaxseed oil? Flaxseed oil is great. I mean, some people it's high in lignans. Well, no, it's not better than fish oil because you have to take flaxseed oil and make EPA and DHA from it, and so it's not efficient at that. The value of flaxseed, for example, is it has high lignans in it, which is very good as a cancer protective for women, especially for breast cancer. So flaxseed oil, but if you're going to really do flaxseeds, you should do the fiber because then you get the fiber, which is really good for you. I like flaxseed powder better than oil. Okay, but you can't substitute flaxseed oil for fish oil. They don't equate. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, and I'll get to you next.
I was going to ask you what form of magnesium. What about magnesium glycinate?
What form of magnesium is best? I always pick magnesium based on what the person's need state is. So you just mentioned glycinate. Very well absorbed. And so it's a good magnesium. So it's called it's an amino acid chelate, bisglycinate. If someone had... blood pressure problems, I would give them magnesium taurate because the taurine helps to calm them down and it helps with vessel relaxation. If they don't have a lot of money, right? I'm talking to somebody that doesn't have a lot of money, I'll tell them magnesium citrate because it's pretty cheap. I have to tell them, you know what? Your stools might get a little loose, right? Got to watch that. And then if they're like a fibromyalgia case or they're a runner, you know, I exercise a lot, I tell them malate because malate helps to get rid of the lactic acid more. So it depends for me, the way I do magnesium, on what your need state is. But if you just wanted to use, if you're using glycinate now, you are using a very good magnesium. And I would just recommend stay with that. That's a good magnesium. I do it a little different. Go ahead.
So I'm a bit concerned about just taking supplements and all the suggestions you have until I have better understand the state of my body. And then I'm concerned about tracking it over time. So
sure.
I don't think I should be getting a blood test every 2 weeks. And so is there a program or say a process like every X number of months or weeks I would get a certain test or are there over-the-counter tests?
That's a great question.
So how
would
I set things up so I'm tracking what's going on? I'm not going to poison myself with too much particular substance.
I've never poisoned anyone in 28 years, so we don't poison people. And in fact, we would be more liable for that kind of stuff, because, you know, that's heavily scrutinized. So your risk, if you look at if you stay within the no observed adverse limit dosing, that means that you're not going to poison yourself. And so you would follow safe dosing. And then the other thing is, for example, magnesium, there isn't a good test for magnesium. Serum magnesium only shows if your magnesium in serum is tested, it's only showing whether or not you're going to be prone to stroke out. It's not showing your tissue adequacy. So then people say take a red blood cell magnesium, which is closer. It's a better measurement. But it still isn't a good measurement of tissue magnesium. The fact is, guys, honestly, there has not been nearly enough money spent or dedicated on the metabolomics of nutrition in our bodies and then identifying studies that go with it. And I'd say there's studies on the market you'd spend a lot of money on, and I would say their reputability and their consistency would be questioned, and I would not be in favor of that. So I'd say, to your point of testing, so for example, if I'm giving you magnesium because your blood sugar is elevated, yes. If you're not a diabetic, check it again in 4 to 6 months. If you're doing a program because your homocysteine and CRP was high, so those would be two markers for heart disease, right? And you're going to give folic acid and B12 and B6 to see if your homocysteine comes down, check it in 4 to 6 months. Otherwise, what I usually would have people do, unless we were doing some kind of therapy that would make us have to check sooner, right? Like testosterone replacement or something where you got to check it in, 120 days or at least 90 days. Usually 6 months to a year, get a blood test and just see how you're doing with your program. Some things can be measured a little better in a typical blood test. Zinc, for example, red blood cell zinc is pretty accurate. But unless somebody's really overdosing you, I have to tell you, your chance of becoming toxic from a vitamin or mineral, I've seen it happen. I'm not going to say people coming into me where they've brought in bags and bags of stuff, which I always tell people, look, if it's that hard to stay well, then somebody hasn't figured out the right model for you. It shouldn't be that hard, right? It's not the right, you haven't healed in the right sequence yet, right? You're trying to work on everything at once. That's that old story when you're rebuilding something. Sometimes you got to do the foundation to the house before you try putting the roof on it, right? It's that same thing with your chemistry. So I'd be suspect of anyone trying to give you too much at one time. I'd be suspect of anyone not wanting to do any lab tests on you at all if you're going to a doc or that kind of thing. And then tracking what's real important for most people have I've probably seen 100,000 patients. I mean, with 28 years of 200 patients a week, our clinic was busy. And the majority of people coming into me, either they were already really sick, they're a cancer patient, or they had full bone, like, we don't know what's wrong with you, but you got rheumatoid arthritis and a bunch of other stuff, but you got so much going on, we don't know. Or you have a lot of complaints, but when you go get a blood test, nothing shows up. And so then they give you something for your anxiety or your depression. Nothing's wrong. Quit worrying about it. You're 30 now. You should expect to feel this way. So that's the biggest issue, is you got to really start to track, well, how do I feel? And look on tests, what you look for, just to your point, are your liver enzymes going up? Because your liver enzymes, your liver has to process all this stuff, if it's natural or a drug. If that liver enzyme number is going up and you're not on any drugs, you're taking too many supplements. Okay? I hope that helped. One question, I'll do two. I'll do them fast, or three. I'll do them real fast, I promise. Go ahead. And I'll do you.
A lot of doctors recommend baby aspirin.
Aspirin, right.
Do you think that's going to affect the microflora in your gut?
Baby aspirin doesn't affect the microflora. It doesn't cause a GI bleed at 55 milligrams. If you do 325, it can. The little 83s don't do it. But if you're doing big doses, it does. Eradicate arteriosclerosis? They're saying statins minimize progression right now due to their studies. But if you already have it, it'll regress plaque, right? It'll regress plaque. That's what they're using statins for now. But simvastatin, they've done with that. And there's a few that have been found to do that. So, but then you can do things like we've regressed plaque. Aged garlic regresses plaque. EDTA regresses plaque. But that's too complex of a question for me to answer. EDTA. But it's too complex of a question for you to just run off and buy that and think you're going to plaque yourself. That's why I just want to make a note of that. And then let me get you, and I got to go.
Okay.
That's a great question. You know what, doctor? I am really interested in trying to be more proactive with my health. Try to find a doc, first of all. That could be a challenge, but try to find a doc who's more truly prevention-oriented. Start with this. I want my stress hormones checked and my vitamin D level checked, doc. Start with a couple of things. Don't overwhelm them because they might get scared of you. Start with something, right? I need my vitamin D. I want my stress hormones checked. Gee, you know, what's my blood glucose like, right? Start there, and then you start on a journey of self-discovery, right? You got to start somewhere. All right? So, hope you guys had fun.
We'd like to our thanks to James Lavelle for his comments here today. We'd also like to thank our audience here, as well as those listening on the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.